Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Ana Mateo. This program is for English learners, so we speak a bit slower, and we use words and sentences especially written for people learning English. Here are the stories we have for you on today's program. Dr. Jill Robbins brings us the education report. Today she talks about teaching peace in the classroom. I will return with another words and their stories. This week I teach idioms from the Thanksgiving dinner table. And we end our 30 minutes together with The Making of a Nation, our ongoing U.S. history program. But first, here is Dr. Jill Robbins.
Peace education is a growing area of research at some colleges and universities. Peace education programs often explore subjects covered in the news, such as violence in schools and mental health issues during a quarantine. In Japan this week, Rebecca Oxford was to speak at a meeting of JALT, the Japan Association for Language Teaching. Her subject, the language of peace. Oxford is Professor Emeritus at the University of Maryland in the United States. She says that foreign and second language teacher educators and their students have an important duty to play in fostering peace. She adds, peace is created through communication, and that communication is the main goal of language teacher educators and teachers. Oxford says there are six parts to peace. They are inner peace, interpersonal peace, intergroup peace, intercultural peace, international peace, and ecological peace, or care for the environment. She believes these six terms give teachers a common basis on which to talk about conflict and work for peace. Part of Oxford's approach to the language of peace is to change signs of conflict into respect for the values and hopes of the people involved. She says peace builders should look for the causes of conflict and use this information to reduce violence between people, groups, and cultures. Not everyone agrees on the value of peace education programs. Heather Millstone is with the University of Queensland in Australia. She did research on how peace programs work in Australian schools. Millstone identified three criticisms of the programs. One is the lack of evidence that they work. Another is how peace programs pay attention to a child's relationship with other children instead of on the larger community. Millstone says this puts a responsibility on children to create peace when the society around them is violent. The third criticism is that the programs do not consider cultural values, such as whether an individual or a group is more important in society. One United States-based group has been using criticisms like these to shape its peace education programs. Tim Nation is Executive Director of the Peace Learning Center, or PLC, in Indianapolis, Indiana. He says the PLC began in the 1990s as part of AmeriCorps, a service program similar to the U.S. government's Peace Corps. He told VOA it began working with children who experienced violence at home and then moved to programs to reduce violence in schools.
We saw going through workshops on conflict resolution and then sharing with the kids that this is one of the missing links in our society. We realized that if you could teach young people at an early age, then you could have a larger impact and help kids succeed.
Over the past year, the PLC joined with the tribe's learning community, a social and emotional learning program. Tribes offers training for elementary, middle, and high school teachers, as well as for those working in after-school and youth development programs. Nation says the work of tribes is based on evidence from research into how to build communities in schools and classrooms.
It's helped us with an evidence-based system that is easy to use for teachers and lessons that are easy to use and proven to reduce conflicts and increase academic progress while helping each student learn skills that they can use for a lifetime.
The tribe's learning community has over 5,000 trainers worldwide, with programs in Canada, Australia, and other English-speaking countries. It also offers Spanish language educational materials. Nation notes that with the change to online learning, help with understanding social and emotional learning is what teachers need right now.
And learning social emotional learning skills is really important because that's what you're asked to do in the workforce. When we lose out on our ability to communicate and collaborate, that's not good for the future of our workforce and our society.
HEART is an aid group that promotes humane education. That is, it is a charity promoting social and emotional learning, or SEL. In a recent education story, we reported on the importance of SEL at some schools. PLC, Tribes, and HEART came together to develop tools for teachers to use in classrooms. Everyday circle cards are one example of a short activity teachers can add to each class. It helps students learn the social skills they need at school. The Peace Learning Center offers another kind of workshop on implicit bias, or making stereotypes about groups of people. The PLC offers the Harvard Implicit Bias Test. It is free and available in many different languages. Nation says that after taking the test, students learn to think about and deal with their own biases.
We help them process and reflect on their own biases so they can learn strategies to deal with them.
Jing Lin is a professor of international education policy at the University of Maryland. She teaches classes for educators related to peace and ecological ethics. Lin says peace education programs can help students a lot. Some students have mental health problems because of conflicts at school or in the community. They need to learn how to deal with that worry and mental pressure.
Students need to know about peace, study about peace, but also to study to have peace with themselves, with the society, and also to study to build peace in our world. So there are great benefits in all levels.
Lin suggests organizing groups of students into teams by birth month. Then, in these groups, each person tells their life story. This activity and similar ones can help students come to understand that we are all human beings. Peace education is helpful not just for students, Lin says, and something that everyone needs. I'm Jill Robbins.
Now, words and their stories from VOA Learning English. Thanksgiving is a holiday in the United States that involves family, friends, fellowship, and food. So today we will talk about some English expressions that deal with food and eating. Let's start with the star of many Thanksgiving meals, the turkey. You could say, it's time to talk turkey. When we say that in American English, it means it is time to start talking seriously about a problem and solve it. It does not mean to talk about how dry the cooked turkey is, although that is a common Thanksgiving conversation. Talking turkey is talking direct. For example, let's say some politicians are having a very long meeting about education. They say a lot without really saying anything important. Finally, one of them says, "Look, we need to start talking turkey about our failing schools in the city. They are not going to fix themselves." Now let's move on to a popular side dish, mashed potatoes.
Now, potatoes do not have a strong taste. So, when you make mashed potatoes, it is important to add butter and salt. It is important to butter up those potatoes. But did you know that you can also butter up people? If I butter up my friends, I tell them lots of wonderful things about them. In other words, I flatter them. I give them lots of compliments. However, I don't say these things just to be nice. I want something from them. Back in middle school, I once buttered up my teacher for weeks, hoping to get a better grade. That did not work. It just made him angry. Some people do not like to be flattered or buttered up. The person who you are buttering up might even say, "Don't try to butter me up. Flattery will get you nowhere." Now, let's add some salt to those mashed potatoes. But not too much. If you add too much salt, you make a dish unhealthy, and it is likely to taste bad. Sometimes just a pinch is all you need. A grain of salt is even less. That is the smallest piece of salt. If I take something with a pinch of salt or grain of salt, I do not take it too seriously. For example, one of my friends is known for exaggerating and sometimes lying. One day he tells me that he plans to sell all of his belongings, move to New York City, and become a poet. I take this information with a grain of salt. I've heard these kinds of plans from him before, and they never turn out to be true.
While eating Thanksgiving dinner, you must remember to save room for dessert. The sweet food that comes after dinner is a big part of the celebration. For some reason, pie is more common at Thanksgiving than cake. Pumpkin pie is probably one of the most common in America. But apple, cherry, and pecan pie are often served too. In fact, one dinner may have a collection of different pies. So here is an expression related to pie. If something is very, very easy to do, it is easy as pie. In fact, I have made many, many pies. So I could say, making pie is, you guessed it, easy as pie. You can use this idiom for just about anything that is not too serious. When I invite people to my home for Thanksgiving, I make lots of pie. I want to have enough. This way, everyone gets a slice of the pie. When you get a slice of the pie, it is not always something you can eat. This idiom also means that you get part of the money or profits from a shared deal. Before we end, there is one more Thanksgiving expression we need to talk about. Stuffing is a very popular Thanksgiving food. It is a combination of bread, onions, celery, or other vegetables, and herbs. Some people stuff the mixture into the turkey and bake the whole thing together. While many people serve it as a side dish, some families have a stuffed turkey for Thanksgiving. And, like a turkey, we can also feel stuffed after finishing a big Thanksgiving meal and eating too much. Would you like more turkey? More mashed potatoes? No thanks. I'm stuffed. And that's all for this Words and Their Stories Thanksgiving program. Until next time, I'm Anna Mateo.
And I'm Katie Weaver.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. On July 4th, 1863, a huge Confederate army surrendered at Vicksburg, Mississippi. Union forces had surrounded the city for 47 days. Food was gone. The situation was hopeless. The Confederate commander gave up. The terms of surrender were simple. The Confederate soldiers promised not to fight anymore. In return for this promise, they were released on parole and sent home to their families. Never had Union forces won such a victory. 30,000 Confederate soldiers were now out of the war. 60,000 guns and 170 cannon were now in Union hands. The Mississippi River was now under Union control. Larry West and Morris Joyce continue our story of the American Civil War.
The victory at Vicksburg went to General Ulysses Grant. He was named commander of all Union armies in the West. Then he was sent to Chattanooga, Tennessee. The Union army there had just been defeated in a battle along a little river called the Chickamauga. Now the Union soldiers were resting and reorganizing in Chattanooga. The Confederate line stretched halfway around the city. The Confederates had artillery on Lookout Mountain. They controlled every road into the city, except a rough one through the mountains. They had blocked the Tennessee River, above and below the city. And they had cut the railroad. The Confederate general said he would let hunger force the Union Army to surrender.
Grant arrived in Chattanooga late in October. The city was full of hungry Union soldiers. They had been without supplies for almost a month. Grant wasted no time. He quickly sent troops to fight the Confederate force blocking the Tennessee River. He sent others to fight the Confederates blocking the road to the nearest Union supply center. Within 1 week, supply wagons were rolling into Chattanooga. Within a few weeks, the defeated Union army was ready to fight again.
General Grant sent his men against the middle and ends of the Confederate line at the same time. There were few Confederate soldiers at Lookout Mountain. That end of the line fell easily. The center of the line was along a low hill called Missionary Ridge. It held for a while,
Then Union soldiers, acting without orders, forced their way to the top of the hill. The Confederate line broke. Southern soldiers threw down their guns and ran for their lives. The Confederate army withdrew south into the state of Georgia. Tennessee was completely in Union hands. The way was now open for the armies of the North to march into the heart of the Confederacy.
It was clear that the South could not win the war. Too many Confederate soldiers had fallen in battle. None were left to take their place. Supplies were very low. There was not enough food to eat, no shoes to wear, and little left to fight with. No one held any hope of getting supplies from outside the Confederacy. The South was circled by Union troops and warships. All seemed lost. Yet Confederate soldiers refused to stop fighting. They would not surrender. The war would not end until the Confederate armies were defeated by military force.
There was no question that the North had the military strength. Supplies were no problem. Factories were producing more than ever before. Manpower was no problem. Men continued to join the Union Army. Fewer than before, but still enough to make it a powerful force. The problem with the Union Army was its generals. Some were too careful. Some were unwilling to fight. Some did not know how to fight. The only general who seemed able to win victories was Ulysses Grant. That is why President Abraham Lincoln named Grant commander of all Union armies. Lincoln depended on him to end the Civil War.
Grant went east in March 1864, 5 months after the battle at Chattanooga. He decided to make his headquarters in the field with the Army of the Potomac. He said he would not command from an office in Washington. But he went to the city to explain his plans to President Lincoln. Grant noted that, in the past, the separate Union armies had moved and fought independently. He said they were like a poorly trained team of horses. No two of them ever pulled at the same time in the same direction. Under his command, Grant said, the Union armies would pull together. They would hit the Confederates with so much strength in so many places that the rebels could not stop them. Grant said all the armies would attack at the same time.
Grant spent the month of April preparing for the big campaign. The main target, once again, was the Confederate capital at Richmond, Virginia. The Army of the Potomac had 120,000 men. It would move against Richmond from the north. General Ben Butler had 50,000 men. He would move against Richmond from the east. General Franz Sigel would bring thousands more through the Shenandoah Valley to the northwest. These forces were three times the size of Robert E. Lee's army near Richmond. In the west, William Sherman had three armies with more than 100,000 men. His opponent, Joe Johnston, had just 60,000.
General Grant kept details of the campaign as secret as possible. Reporters asked President Lincoln when Grant would move. the president answered, "Ask General Grant." "General Grant will not tell us," said the reporters. Said Lincoln, "He will not tell me either." The final Union campaign of the Civil War began on May 3, 1864. After 2 days of marching, the Army of the Potomac reached the Wilderness. It was a thickly wooded area west of Fredericksburg, Virginia. That was where the Union Army had lost a battle to the Confederates 1 year before. That was where the two armies would fight again.
The battle quickly became a blind struggle. The woods were thick. The smoke was heavy. The soldiers could not see each other until they were very close. Shells set the trees on fire. The wounded could not escape the flames. Their screams filled the air. After 2 days, General Grant decided that the Wilderness was not the place to fight Robert E. Lee. He wanted to get around the end of Lee's army. He wanted to fight in the open, where he could use his artillery. So, he began to march his men toward a place called Spotsylvania Courthouse.
Lee moved his men as fast as Grant. When the Union Army got to Spotsylvania, the Confederates were waiting behind walls of earth and stone. For several more days, the two armies fought. At times, they were so close they had no time to load and fire their guns. So, they used their guns to hit each other. The Confederate line bent, but it never broke. Once again, Lee had stopped the Union Army. Grant refused to accept defeat. He said he would fight to the finish, if it took all summer. Once again, he ordered his men to march around the end of Lee's line. Lee quickly pulled his men back to a place called Cold Harbor, not far from Richmond. There they waited.
As he had done in the Wilderness and at Spotsylvania, Grant ordered his men to attack hard. It was a slaughter. In less than an hour, 7,000 Union soldiers fell dead or wounded. Grant finally stopped the attack. The Union soldiers returned to their lines. They left behind hundreds of wounded men. For 4 days, the wounded lay on the battlefield crying for help, for water. Men who tried to rescue them were shot down. Finally, Grant and Lee agreed on a ceasefire to take care of the wounded and bury the dead. It was too late for most of the wounded. They had died.
The battle at Cold Harbor ended 1 month of fighting for the Army of the Potomac. The campaign had brought it almost to the edge of Richmond, the Confederate capital. But Grant had paid a terrible price. More than 50,000 dead and wounded. Confederate losses were much lighter, about 20,000. General Grant was beginning to learn an important lesson of the war. The methods of defense had improved much more than the methods of attack.
And that is our program for today. Thank you for listening. Join us again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world.